the headlines. The United States rejects a Poland offer to send fighter jets to Ukraine via an American airbase, saying it raises serious concerns for NATO. A report says Saudi and Emirati leaders decline calls with the U.S. president as Washington is working to build international support for Ukraine and contain a surge in oil prices. South Koreans are voting for a new president in a race branded by local media as the election of the unfavorables. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in Iranian capital Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Washington says no to an offer by Warsaw to transfer Poland-owned fighter jets to Ukraine through U.S. airbase. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby believes Poland's offer is not a tenable one. He says Warsaw is the party to decide whether it wants to send its own jets to Ukraine, and the transferring the jets via U.S. NATO airbase in exchange for American fighter aircraft would raise serious concerns for the military alliance. The Polish Foreign Ministry has proposed that its entire fleet of Soviet-era MiG and Sukhoi fighter jets be immediately sent to Ukraine through an airbase inside Germany. In return, Warsaw has asked Washington to provide it with used aircraft with the same operational capabilities. The move could increase tensions with Russia because it has warned that sending weapons to Ukraine could lead to a global collapse. Only days after Russia said that Kiev is eliminating traces of its biological weapons program, here's an acknowledgement from a U.S. official that Ukraine has indeed been housing biological research facilities.
Ukraine has biological research facilities, which, in fact, we are now quite concerned Russian troops, Russian forces may be seeking to gain control of. So we are working with the Ukrainians on how they can prevent any of those research materials from falling into the hands of Russian forces.
Russian authorities said on Monday that Ukraine has established more than 30 biological laboratories on its territory at the request of the U.S. Reacting to the news, China is now urging Washington to release all details of the programs. Beijing wants the relevant parties to ensure the safety of the laboratories. Referring to the U.S. activities in Ukraine, the Chinese Foreign Ministry said it's only the tip of the iceberg. Earlier, the UK Defense Ministry refuted Moscow's claims, saying they're only meant to justify the military operation. Saudi and Emirati leaders have snubbed President Joe Biden and refused to speak to him in recent weeks. According to the Wall Street Journal, there has been some expectation of a phone call after earlier contacts by the White House were declined, but that those calls never came. Biden was apparently meaning to encourage the two Arab producers to pump more oil into the market to bring down energy prices in the U.S. Washington has been attempting to push an array of oil-producing countries, including its adversary Venezuela, to balance the impact of Russia's Ukraine attack on energy markets. The U.S. president is reportedly considering a trip to Saudi Arabia to resolve differences with Crown Prince bin Salman over a host of issues. Gas prices in the U.S. Hit an all-time high as President Joe Biden announces a full ban on energy supplies from Russia. Americans now have to pay an average of almost $4.2 per gallon at the gas pump, surpassing the previous high in 2008. And now, with U.S. President Biden's ban on Russian oil and gas imports taking effect, the prices are expected to go up even more steeply. Russia exports more than 12% of the world's crude oil. Any supply disruption will affect the cost of oil globally. American households are also grappling with the highest inflation rate in over 40 years. The United States has just banned Russian energy imports, but a whirlwind diplomatic tour by its Secretary of State has failed to convince Europe to do the same. The U.S. is pushing NATO members to send fighter jets to Ukraine, which many fear will deteriorate the situation. Rami Mazahiri has more on the story.
United States Secretary of State Antony Blinken wrapped up a visit to the leaders of six European nations, plus a visit with the European Union and Israel's foreign minister, with a closed-door meeting with French President Emmanuel Macron. Washington has just announced a ban on Russian fossil fuels, but Blinken has apparently not convinced the European Union to immediately sever energy ties with their primary supplier. Russia announced they would cut its oil supplies to Europe if they introduced energy sanctions, which would have a devastating economic impact, perhaps globally. In what many say is an effort to avoid peace and increase the likelihood of a major war, Blinken recently announced that NATO members can send fighter jets to Ukraine. The U.S. and Europe have already provided significant military aid to Ukraine and imposed sanctions so potentially sweeping that Russian Federation President Vladimir Putin recently said they were, quote, like a war.
France is not directly concerned in this conflict, and yet they've already overdone it. When their foreign minister declared an all-out economic and financial war against Russia, that is an act of war. However, there's no economic coherence here because Europe completely depends on Russia for gas, petrol, and titanium, while the loss of export sales to Russia would be a catastrophe for European agriculture.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky recently announced that he, quote, understood that NATO is not prepared to accept Ukraine, end quote, which appears to be a concession to one of Russia's primary demands to end its military operation. The risk of expanding the conflict is a major concern, and with Washington giving Russia a cold shoulder since their offensive, Macron has served as the West's primary mediator with Moscow.
Macron has failed in his mediations because he and Germany have not been able to convince Ukraine to respect the Minsk agreements. If Macron had been able to convince Ukraine of this, then things could have been quite different. France should have been able to achieve this, but the United States obviously didn't want it.
Since 2014, some 14,000 people have been killed in Ukraine. Russia's offensive on February 24th has produced almost 500 civilian deaths and nearly 2 million refugees, according to the United Nations. In recent years, many politicians have argued that the European Union is necessary in order to have peace on the continent. However, forming an EU army, sending arms within Europe, and waging a sanctions war which is sure to hurt the Russian people doesn't seem peaceful to many. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Italy's energy minister has announced the country can cope without Russian gas even if Moscow suddenly cuts off its gas supplies. Meanwhile, the EU has published plans to slash its imports of Russian gas by two-thirds this year. Max Reilly has more on this report.
As the Russian-Ukrainian conflict gets more bellicose by the day, European countries are trying to find ways to free themselves from Russian gas dependency. Italy has been importing gas from Russia for over 50 years. Its gas imports from Moscow currently stands at about 40% of its total demand. However, Energy Minister Roberto Cingolani said on Tuesday that Rome can cope without Russian gas should President Vladimir Putin decide to halt supplies in retaliation to sanctions and arms sales to Ukraine.
Why has Russian gas served us well for decades? Because it is very convenient. The gas is relatively cheap, of high quality, and it runs through an old pipeline that was paid off long ago. In 1994, Italy used to produce about 30 billion cubic meters of gas. Now it only produces one-tenth of that.
Italy ponders over a new energy strategy which includes building liquefied natural gas terminals, increasing its regasification capacity, and being less dependent on gas pipelines. The Italian government believes it might take 24 to 30 months to achieve its ends. This, as the European Union has rolled out plans to considerably cut its import of Russian gas in 2022. EU published plans on Tuesday aiming to slash Russian gas dependence by two-thirds by the end of this year. The bloc imported 155 billion cubic meters of natural gas from Russia last year, which equals to almost half of its gas imports.
Should Russia cut off gas supplies to Europe, it would be a big mess. There is no way Brussels would be able to replace such a big gas supplier in a short time. It's great that the EU has outlined state aid for struggling companies across Europe. Energy bills are three, four times more expensive than before. For over 20 years, we've been saying to governments that energy diversification was the way to go, but we were seen as fools. I think Qatar and Iran can be among the new gas suppliers for us.
the EU intends to create its own energy resources by accelerating the rollout of renewable energy, biofuels and hydrogen. However, for the time being and the immediate future, Brussels will have to find new sources of gas and commit to lowering energy consumption by cutting energy use. Max Civili, Rome.
South Koreans are going to the polls to elect their 20th president in a race branded by the media as the election of the unfavorables. From the 14 registered candidates, the two leading ones are Lee Jae-myung, who represents the ruling Democratic Party, and Yoon Suk-yeol from the conservative main opposition People Power Party. Both candidates were running neck-to-neck in the latest polls, but scandals and accusations of corruption have left them largely unpopular. Whoever gets elected will replace incumbent President Moon Jae-in for a five-year term. Younger voters are said to have a pivotal role to play in this election. Soaring housing prices and inequalities, the COVID pandemic, unemployment, and anxiety over North Korea are the main challenges for the new administration. Frank Smith is joining us now from Seoul. Frank, please bring us up to speed on the latest details regarding the polls. And if you can, please explain for us why this election is being called the election of the unfavorables.
Well, let's start off with how voting is going so far. Early ballots cast reached record right now as about p.m. local. More than 7 eligible voters had cast their ballots, and that's a record level for that time. Also, polls are going to be extended from 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. to allow those about a million or so South Koreans that are currently suffering or self-isolated with COVID-19. There were some irregularities with those early voters, though, with the campaign officials taking the ballots of people that have COVID-19 and placing them, according to reports, in garbage bags. And some people getting ballot envelopes that already had filled in ballots in them and mishandling them because they didn't want the COVID-19 patients to put their ballots directly into the ballot boxes. So they have organized some other remedies for that for Election Day, having separate waiting areas for COVID-19 patients and allowing them to put their ballots directly into the boxes. But, you know, this really promises to be a highly contentious vote, not just because of these irregularities, but as you mentioned, because of the kind of unpopularity of the two candidates. Yoon Suk-yeol has been accused of being a misogynist. He's, tainted by scandal himself with his wife apparently plagiarizing or using fraudulent information in job applications, and Lee Jae-myung being connected to a real estate scandal when he was mayor of Songnam City, just south of Seoul. So, you know, these two candidates are certainly kind of unpopular, and that may be what's driving out the high voting rate today.
And Frank, if you can also tell us some about the challenges that a new government will face in South Korea.
Well, you know, today they just announced the COVID-19 pandemic reaching a record level of 340,000 people. That's in a total population of 52 million. 340,000 people have been found to have contracted COVID-19 in the last 24-hour period, with a record 159 deaths, now approaching 10,000 casualties here in South Korea, which had dealt so well with the pandemic early on. So the incumbent, the next president of South Korea, is going to have some real challenges ahead of him getting past the COVID-19 pandemic and also addressing the geopolitical challenges South Korea faces with the war in Ukraine, as South Korea is a large energy importer. Almost 100% of its energy is imported, and those costs are going to go up, and that's going to affect the South Korean economy. So some serious challenges on those two fronts, as well as the issues that we've already mentioned, housing and inequality, and also for young people, jobs. Youth here represent a real swing vote, as they lowered the voting age from 19 to 18. And as well, we have 5 years since the previous election. So a lot of new voters and a lot of kind of uncertainty with this election really up for grabs here.
All right, thanks a lot. Frank Smith joining us from Seoul. Elsewhere, another Palestinian has lost his life following an attack by the Israeli forces as tensions run high in the occupied territories. Palestinian sources say the 23-year-old man succumbed to his injuries sustained in an attack by troops in the city of Nablus a few days ago. The West Bank has been the scene of daily escalations, with Israeli forces killing several Palestinians within days. The UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East peace process has expressed deep concern over the deteriorating security situation. Iran strongly condemns the latest Israeli missile strike against Syria as a criminal act of aggression, occupation, and assassination. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says responding to the regime's crimes against humanity is one of the main goals of the resistance campaign. In the region, Israeli airstrikes hit targets near the Syrian capital, Damascus, on Monday. During that attack, two members of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps were killed. The IRGC has vowed to avenge the death of its members. In a statement, it said the Zionist regime will undoubtedly pay the price for its atrocity. There are a number of Iranian military advisors in Syria as requested by the Damascus government. Carrying attacks on Syrian territory has become a common Israeli practice. The Syrian government has on numerous occasions asked the United Nations to hold Tel Aviv accountable for its continued aggression. Iran says success of the ongoing talks on the revival of the 2015 deal depends on correct political decisions by the U.S. and other parties to the accord. This is according to Iran's acting ambassador to Vienna-based international organizations, Mohammad Reza Ghaibi. He said if the other JCPOA parties and the U.S. show goodwill in the Vienna talks and make necessary political decisions to remove inhuman sanctions on Iran, successful conclusion of the negotiations will be quite possible. Ghaibi recalled that the failure of the three European parties to the accord to hold up their end of the deal forced Tehran to scale back its commitments. He, however, noted that Iran's move was within the framework of the 2015 accord. 8 rounds of talks have been held between Iran and the other JCPOA signatories to Vienna to salvage the deal after Washington's 2018 withdrawal threw it into disarray. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Most analysts acknowledge that Russia is not essentially seeking to occupy Ukraine, but the Europeans are trying to use Ukraine as a logistical shield to resolve their differences with Russia, especially over natural gas. We now present you an article written by Faizeh Akbar Shahi, an international relations expert. The piece is titled, West, the True Beginner of War in Ukraine. Ernest Hemingway, an American novelist, short story writer, and journalist, says, "Once we have a war, there is only one thing to do. It must be won. For defeat brings worse things than any that can ever happen in war." Any analysis of international developments would be incomplete and even misguided if their historical roots are not taken into consideration. This is true about the ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine, which looks like a puzzle. To have a complete image, all pieces of the puzzle must be arranged in the correct order. Therefore, in order to analyze the conflict thoroughly, a special piece of the puzzle needs to be taken into consideration. And that is the armed conflict in 2014 in Ukraine's Donbas region between the government of Ukraine and the independent regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. Both regions were supported by Russia. The conflict was followed by 29 instances of ceasefire, during which the West, especially the European countries, intervened in support of the Ukrainian government. The flame of war, which according to many analysts had already started 8 years ago, was fanned in the middle of February 2022. It began with an attack on a nursery by the Ukrainian forces and subsequent threats by Russia, and was finally ensued with Russia's special military operation on 24th of February. In the case of an attack on the U.S. Capitol building on 6th of January 2021 and its interpretations by both Republican and Democratic media outlets provided fodder for Western political analysts for a long time to come. Some called it a movement, while others used such words as assault and insurgency to describe that incident in a bid to shed light on various aspects of it. All of them, especially Democratic media outlets and writers, converged on one point, that fighting of extremists and neo-Nazi groups as well as anti-democracy militia supporting former US President Donald Trump was requisite if democracy was to stand in place. The question is, do they think along the same lines when it comes to extremist forces in other parts of the world, including in Ukraine? The neo-Nazi Azov Battalion, which was formed on Ukrainian soil in May of 2014 and has been heavily armed by the United States ever since, is among the extremist groups that, apart from torturing and killing local residents and militia forces in the autonomous oblasts of Ukraine, is engaged in illegal organ trade, drug trafficking, and attacks on ethnic minorities. Members of the regiment are those who produced and released the video footage of their bullets being soaked with pig fat, claiming they wanted to prevent Muslim soldiers in the Russian armed forces from going to heaven. In addition to confronting the group with the intention of its disarmament and denazification, Russia is also trying to prevent NATO from invading its borders. In all its years of operation, NATO has equipped its member states with various weapons of mass destruction and has turned into a major den of espionage that seeks to restrict Russia, both politically and ideologically. Therefore, it's worth mentioning that Moscow has been primarily seeking over the past few days to weaken Kiev's political structure and disarm the Eastern European country as part of its efforts to prevent continuation of what has been mysteriously going on since 2008. Meanwhile, active progress and dominance in Luhansk and Donetsk regions have helped Russia gain the upper hand in negotiations with Ukraine over the recognition of the Crimean Peninsula. Meanwhile, active progress and dominance in Luhansk and Donetsk regions have helped Russia gain the upper hand in negotiations with Ukraine over the recognition of the Crimean Peninsula. Because Europe is dependent on the Russian natural gas, Europeans are trying to increase the number of casualties, prolong the conflict, and present the Russian military campaign as bloody as possible, in order to evoke emotions, strike up an anti-Russia alliance, and isolate Russia. That is why the Europeans are constantly giving Ukraine hollow promises and are keeping the country in limbo of EU membership and fulfillment of accession requirements. Ukraine's membership in the European Union can be assessed in the same manner, given the fact that the European Union has been facing a political crisis and dispute with member states in the past few years over the admission of immigrants. Most analysts acknowledge that Russia is not essentially seeking to occupy Ukraine, but the Europeans are trying to use Ukraine as a logistical shield to resolve their differences with Russia, especially over natural gas. But Westerners need two effective tools to do that. Firstly, they need a package of comprehensive sanctions measures, something which has prompted states to adopt contradictory and even ridiculous positions in recent days. For instance, the boycott of Russian film productions at the 2022 Cannes Film Festival. Secondly, they need broad psychological operations to bring nations together. The mainstream media follow two basic techniques in its psychological warfare against Russia. They recount the Russia-Ukraine crisis regardless of its historical roots and political reasons, and the Russian narrative of the conflict is lost as a result. The media outlets also try to propagate the notion that tensions between Russia and Ukraine have transformed into a bloody war. While the current conflict between Russia and Ukraine can be interpreted as street fighting, concrete facts state that Russian armed forces are by no means fond of street clashes. The Russian military does not launch a war without utilization of all of its facilities, including air force and missile units. Moscow maintains that civilians are not being attacked by Russian armed forces in Ukraine. Russia's goal, ever since the conflict broke out nearly 2 weeks ago, is to change the political structure of Ukraine and disarm it militarily. It is because of such goals that the conflict has continued, not what has been described as the resistance of the Ukrainian government.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, commonly known as NATO, is notorious for its military intervention around the world in the past decades, from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya to former Yugoslavia, with millions of people falling victim to its operations. NATO's eastward expansion has caused growing frictions with Russia recently, a plan that Moscow regards as a threat to its existence. And now with the current conflict between Russia and Ukraine, NATO's stated goal of maintaining peace and security on the international stage has come under question. Now, this edition of Spotlight will take a look at NATO's past and current positions, its failures and challenges, and try to figure out to what extent it could be blamed for the current crisis in Ukraine. Hello and welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let's see who's going to join us in this edition of the Spotlight. We'll have David Swanson, director of the World Beyond War from Charlottesville. Also joining us will be Mike Harris, editor of the Veterans Today in Phoenix, Arizona.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show. Now, David, to begin with, let's take a look back at history. NATO was structured around anti-Soviet aims some 70 years ago, as you know, to contain threats from the Warsaw Pact and the communist bloc. Now, with the collapse of the Iron Curtain after 1989, many predicted that NATO would disintegrate, but it didn't happen. Why?
Well, you know, the Warsaw Pact has been gone for 30 years, and that was the moment for NATO to be dismantled and shut down. It obviously wouldn't self-disintegrate. Someone had to do it, and the courage and the sensibility were not there. In large part because the stated purpose was to keep Russia out, keep the United States in, and keep Germany down. And those two goals of keeping the United States in Europe and keeping Germany down didn't go anywhere. And there was a fortune to be made in selling weapons to Eastern Europe if NATO could expand. And so promises were made, let Germany reunify, NATO won't expand an inch eastward. And the promises were broken. When Bill Clinton was president, you had three countries added. When George W. Bush was president, another seven, and two more countries each for Obama and Trump, with no end in sight.
Okay. Now, Mike, let's review some botched NATO operations around the world. Let's start with Libya. Then U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said that NATO was responsible to enforce a no-fly zone and to protect civilian lives. But on the ground, what happened was that the mission turned out to be aimed at regime change, and which, as you saw, brought chaos to the country, not democracy. And it's still, you know how things are in Libya. So let's have your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, Hillary Clinton has been a very destructive force within U.S. politics for a very long time. She seems to have the fecal touch. Everything she touches turns very bad. So that being given, what happened in Libya was a crime against humanity here, where they went in and destabilized a regime that was promoting peace and wealth and prosperity throughout Africa, putting out the African currencies on a gold standard, which threatened the Western banking interests. That is the one thing that no country is allowed to do, is either resist or threaten banking interests of the West. So that's why Libya was destroyed, and that was an unmitigated failure. In addition to which, there's great support for the speculation that Hillary Clinton and others within the U.S. Department of State were trafficking weapons through Libya intended to be put into Syria to topple the Bashar al-Assad regime. So there's a lot of hijinks and a lot of U.S. Exploitation of other countries going on out there, where the U.S. wants to destabilize these up-and-coming regimes and topple them, bring chaos in so that they can't organize and can't form any sort of cogent resistance against them. Then the resources of that country are laid wide open for any U.S. company or any Western company that wants to come in and exploit them. So really, this is very financially oriented, and it's really piracy by sovereign states. And that's what the U.S. has been doing for some time. And NATO is essentially a tool of the U.S. State Department.
Mm-hmm. Now, David, we can also mention NATO-led operation in Afghanistan, which have in most cases resulted in the killing of a large number of civilians and failed to achieve its goals. And Western forces left Afghanistan in a humiliating way, and they left the legacy of simply further misery for Afghans. Your thoughts on that?
no question, and ongoing and being exacerbated, and many, many men, women, and children threatened with starvation due to the theft of funds. This is a problem that needs addressing immediately. NATO, in the minds of many people in the United States, is some sort of an international body, vaguely like the United Nations, which they've vaguely heard of. And so there's this idea that if you have a large enough gang engaged in a crime, it's sort of legalistic-ish. And so the United States loves to call wars NATO wars rather than U.S. wars, and can persuade people that therefore they are legal and acceptable and respectable. And of course, this is not the case. NATO is the very madness that created World War One. NATO, NATO now engages in these, you know, foreign imperial wars and destructive pseudo-humanitarian bombings. But NATO, what it was supposed to be, when people say get NATO back to its original purpose, it was supposed to be the madness that created World War One, the agreement to jump into any wars that any other NATO members get in. Which is, of course, why NATO doesn't actually want Ukraine in NATO anytime soon, and why no country has the right to join NATO, because you don't have the right to compel a bunch of other countries to join in all of your wars. Not only was NATO used to go after Libya, and not only does NATO shield the U.S. Military from investigations by Congress when Congress finds the spine to do any such thing, because they just passed the buck to NATO, but the lawyer that President Barack Obama used to sell Congress and the U.S. public on the legality of attacking Libya appeared yesterday at the International Court of Justice to represent Ukraine, arguing for the illegality of Russia attacking a sovereign state. Mm-hmm. Russia didn't show up, by the way. So the hypocrisy, it could not be more stark.
Okay. Now, Mike, let's turn to the former Yugoslavia and see what NATO did there. We have reports of, the bombing killing 500 civilians there, infrastructure in ruins, the schools, hospitals were razed. Also in Kosovo, the bombing lasted 3 months before the war came to an end. The legitimacy of NATO air campaign in Kosovo has been questioned, so has the number of civilian casualties in there. And also we have the UN International Criminal Tribunal for former Yugoslavia establishing NATO's use of depleted uranium and cluster bombs in its military intervention in Yugoslavia in 1999.
Well, the U.S. has a history of using depleted uranium in Iraq as well, particularly in Fallujah. And as a result, that area is going to be the quality of life that's possible there, capable there, has been greatly depleted. The same thing going for Kosovo. NATO is really a U.S. proxy. U.S. calls the shot. U.S. pays the bill. Remember Donald Trump coming out and saying that the NATO countries aren't paying their fair share. They've got to pay their fair share. Remember Donald Trump also calling for the dissolution of NATO, because the whole mandate of why NATO exists was to contain the Soviet Union and their westward expansion. NATO was there to stop that. Well, the Soviet Union doesn't exist, and there are elements within our State Department, particularly Zionist elements, that wish to recreate the Cold War situation that we had back then, because that was good business for them. It's not good for the American people. It's not good for the people of Europe. The real elegant solution to what's going on now is to dissolve NATO and invite Russia and Ukraine both into the EU and make it sort of a more of a commercial pact versus a defensive pact. So there's many eloquent workarounds here. But, like I said, NATO has been out of control for some time and has been acting as a U.S. proxy. And it's time to hold the U.S. State Department and our government officials, who proceed through multiple administrations, and hold them accountable for what is in the best interest of the American people. That is where a Department of State seems to have lost its way, and they seem to be serving another master, which is not what we're set up to do as a country, how our republic is organized. But we seem to be more of a vassal state for a little small sliver of a country down in the eastern Mediterranean someplace that has an inordinate amount of influence over all of American policy. And this has got to end. It's time for this to stop. It's time for the United States government and all of its many iterations to come to serve the people who put it in power and who fund its existence, and get an America First agenda and not be a foreign policy tool for that little small country over there in, we call it Israel. Anyway, Palestine's a real name. Mm-hmm.
Now, David, General Galvin, former commander of U.S. European Command of NATO, told U.S. Congress that 150,000 U.S. troops will remain in Europe indefinitely for two purposes: to counter ethnic and nationalistic eruption in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet republics, and to be available for rapid deployment outside of Europe to counter a, quote, uncertain enemy. What does this signify? I mean, NATO should always have an enemy, certain, uncertain. They need to create enemies in order to justify their raison d'etre?
Absolutely. There's very much of a self-fulfilling vicious circle here. You cannot have this level of weapons sales, this arming of the globe without enemies. Enemies are absolutely essential. And NATO is becoming a global imperial alliance of weapons customers, of largely U.S., but also French, U.K., other big weapons-producing countries' customers. NATO not only has all of these countries in Europe pushing ever eastward, but has these alliances with numerous other countries, potential future NATO members, and countries that are nowhere near the North Atlantic that are partnering with NATO. And this is seen, again, by a lot of people as somehow making things more legal, whereas this is not the United Nations. This is not a democratized United Nations. This is a military alliance. And you have people in the United States, from top politicians to academics to ordinary, who will say, what, would you abandon the world? Would you ignore and avoid and isolate the rest of the world rather than be in NATO? As if a death pact, as if a war pact were the only way to associate with other countries, as if you could not associate with other countries nonviolently, cooperatively, legally, as if you couldn't work on the problems we have no choice but to face, the environmental and disease and refugee and nuclear threats, rather than a military alliance that generates the problems, as in Ukraine, that it then claims to need to step in and solve.
Okay. Now, let's take a look at what's happening today, Mike. This Russia-Ukraine thing. And Russia has cited its own concerns, NATO's eastward expansion. It's been warning time and time again, but this is what happened. So how justified, in your opinion, are Russia's concerns regarding NATO's expansion and activities?
Well, in my opinion, Vladimir Putin and the Russian position on Ukraine, as well as the ongoing expansion eastward, is spot on. The U.S. caused the problem in Ukraine when Victoria Nuland spent $5 billion U.S. tax dollars to topple the duly elected, legitimately elected Viktor Yanukovych regime. And so since then, that's when these dominoes started to fall that's led us to this situation here. And this talk about allowing Ukraine into NATO is absurd, because James Baker made promises to Gorbachev that there would be no eastward expansion toward the Russian border. And then, of course, NATO and the U.S. broke every promise they've ever made. The bottom line is that the U.S. has become the villain of the world, and everything that they say is you can't trust them. I mean, our friends can't trust us, our enemies can't trust us. So any word that they make, any commitment that they give, is not to be believed. They're there to be, as Reagan said, trust but verify. No, don't even bother to trust the U.S. because they will betray you. They betrayed Saddam Hussein. They betrayed Manuel Noriega, who were both allies of the U.S. And they threw him under the bus. And the other guest, Mr. Swanson, was really correct. He's hinted around something. And that is, after World War II, the U.S. Defense contractors, the providers of these defensive and armament systems and platforms, they enjoyed making huge profits. They enjoyed it a lot. So they've engaged in ongoing war, ongoing skirmishes, ever since the end of World War II. I mean, we're out of World War II a couple of years, and there's Korea. They're out a couple of years, and there's Vietnam. With the event of 9/11, they created the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. These companies have so much influence over U.S. policy, and they consume so much money through military spending that it is obscene. And the U.S. needs to wean itself off of the defense as an industry, as a national export here, and come up with something that is much more productive. Maybe retool these defense contractors for exploration of space, for instance. There's more money in that than there is in destroying life on this planet and destroying other countries. So the U.S. population has had about enough of this criminal regime that is in power now, and not just the Biden regime, but going back to George H.W. Bush, you know, egregious mistakes have been made that damage American interests and damage the position of the American people. And they've lost the support of the population. That's as simple as I can put it. This country is really in trouble right now, and we're tottering on, you know, open civil unrest. And I'd like to avoid that, but the U.S. government has got to stop its expansionist, imperialistic adventures overseas. And I never thought I would be the one to use the word imperialist, because I've always been virulently anti-communist. And for me to say these words and to see what the U.S. government is doing, it's really been an eye-opener for me and quite humbling that the U.S. has got to stop what it's doing. It has to be a better global citizen than what it's been for the last 30, 40, 50 years, actually 70 years since the end of World War II.
Okay. Now, David, let's take a look at the reasons why NATO has been refusing calls, and some very desperate calls, as Zelensky was talking to the House of Commons in the U.K. today, to act against Russia. Is this a sign of weakness on the part of NATO, as Kiev puts it?
First of all, let's be very, very clear. Nothing can justify or make reasonable Russia's invasion and attack on the nation of Ukraine. Yes, Russia had perfectly reasonable demands for months leading up to, and NATO and the United States and Ukraine refused to meet them or even take them seriously. But that does not begin to justify mass murder, which is absolutely inexcusable, no matter who is engaging in it or why. Russia now has quite reasonable demands, and Ukraine refuses to take them seriously or to talk, and Zelensky rather nonsensically acts as if Russia is refusing to negotiate, while he himself refuses to say anything specific to suggest the possibility of meeting any demands or making any demands of his own. So, you know, again, you have to have an enemy, and that enemy has to be an irrational madman that you can't talk with. Otherwise, you're going to have to talk with him or her or them. Right. You know, so this is the problem with the U.S. and Western influence on Ukraine and the position of the Zelensky government. There does not seem to be openness to anything other than escalation, and this risks nuclear apocalypse.
Now, Mike, let's turn to some prediction. What's the future holding for security arrangement, especially in Europe and for NATO, given the fact that, you know, France and some other countries have been pushing for, you know, creating this European army? So what's going to happen to NATO?
Well, first, I have to disagree with the other guest on one point that he made, that mass murder by the Russians of the Ukrainians. Understand that most of the Ukrainian people are of Russian descent and are very similar to the Russians who are coming in. They share a common language. They share a common genetic. I think Putin and the Russian armed forces have done an inordinately good job of trying to avoid civilian casualties. And so I want to disagree on that small point.
But about stop the bombing of, them. You'll avoid them altogether.
Well, no, I think you're misreading this here, and you know, I appreciate your perspective. However, I disagree with it. But the U.S. would not tolerate China putting something on the Mexican border. Russia should not tolerate it, because, you know, the road into Moscow is right through Ukraine. So I think they have legitimate self-defense interests there that Putin is defending. Now, there is the issue here where the Ukrainian borders have never been articulated or defined going back to 1991. So there is a claim to be made that that is Russian territory still. And so there is a number of issues here. But to answer the question about what the future looks forward to, I kind of see that, you know, the Russians have the superior position right now, because They can shut off all the oil and gas into Europe, and the Germans and many others are going to have a very long, cold winter. It's going to shut down their economy. It's going to shut down their industry. So there's a lot of other cards and a lot of other levers that Putin can use that don't require any military actions at all. Like the SWIFT system, if they're going to cut Russia out of the SWIFT system, then expect the oil and gas into Europe to go off, and for life in Europe to get very, very tough. But these are all escalations, and what we need to do is de-escalate the situation to avoid the situation. And from what I understand, the Russian view on this is more of a police action to remove the corruption from Ukraine that the West has put in there. Like I said, Victoria Nuland toppled the duly elected government and allowed Western, you know, corrupt interests to come in there. Look at directly at Joe Biden and the millions that have been paid to his son through this Burisma thing. Biden wants Ukraine destroyed so they can destroy all the evidence of his bribery and everything else. Understand that Ukraine is the global nexus now for drug trafficking, for human trafficking of both women and children, and for arms trafficking. And so you understand these things. You understand the criminality, the corruption that exists in Ukraine. And if I was Vladimir Putin, I wouldn't want that next to my country either. So I think what he's doing is trying to protect the Russian people of Ukraine, as well as protect Russia proper. And so I don't support violence, but I do support his position.
Except for the violence that you support.
Okay, unfortunately, that's all the time we have, gentlemen. Sorry for jumping. And let me thank our guests. We had David Swanson, director of the World Beyond War in Charlottesville, and Mike Harris, editor of the Veterans Today from Phoenix, Arizona, for their contribution. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being. A brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: ليس بلد بأحق بك من بلد، خير البلاد ما حملك.
أمير المؤمنين إمام علي عليه السلام stated: No town has greater right on you than the other. The best town for you is that which bears you.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, of the programs To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. We find, dear friends, that in the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, this first divinely appointed Imam, this living miracle of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, we find that Imam Ali has taught us a certain kind of lifestyle, as well as these ethical and moral qualities that can really lead us to perfection, and they can lead us towards a happier life, a more satisfied life, a content life, if you will. It is interesting, there are many times when we say things that later on turn out to be quite harmful to us. I'm sure we have all been through one of these kind of instances where we didn't really think before we answered or we replied, or perhaps we said something out of anger or stress or frustration or grief. And then again, later on, we regret it that we said a certain thing. And so interestingly, well over 1,000 years ago, and I mean, sometimes we just very easily say 1,000 years. 1,000 years is a long time ago. But over 1,000 years ago, Imam Ali alayhi salam said that if you want to be immune from the harms and the damages of that which you say, remain silent. It is so interesting, but in today's day and age, it just seems like we always want to talk and we don't even want to think before we speak, even though that's one of these golden rules of life, right? We should think before we speak. And here Imam Ali is telling us, if you want to remain immune and you want to remain safe from these harms that are incurred upon a person because of what they say, then remain silent. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that we remain silent all the time, we never say anything, we don't talk to anyone. No, it just means that we should try to think before we speak, and that we should not be hasty in speaking. And so again, a very beautiful and profound lesson. If we want to stay safe from the harms of what we say, then practice remaining silent. Brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
فلا تبي ولها ولا رغيب